A little bit lost. My wife and I were living in downtown Wheaton, right above Alpha Graphics. You guys know what I'm talking about. And we had a rooftop garden up there, a rooftop that became a garden after my wife gave me a few seeds one Easter. And I started growing them, and I was like, okay, this is cool. Really naively, I wanted to do it all organically. So there's pots existing there with soil, and I was assuming that it was bad soil, chemicals, you know, bad. So I dumped all the soil out over the roof and in the dumpster, and then went to the hardware store and got topsoil and lugged up bag after bag after topsoil, or bag after bag of topsoil up to my apartment, off onto my roof, and grew vegetables in topsoil with nothing else in it, just dead soil. So I got two tomatoes from two plants. But I was hooked, and I was ready to go. So that started my path on agriculture. The next year, I interned at the Green Earth Institute that Jane spoke so well of. I was second everything she said about that wonderful organization. And shortly after that, I ended up volunteering at Heritage Prairie Farm. It was the first year of 2008, and I really got to know some of the great farmers that were there. So there it is, Heritage Prairie Farm. Let me tell you a little bit about, now you know how I got to the farm, a little bit about how the farm came to be. Bronwyn Weaver and Bob Archibald started Heritage Prairie Farm. Simply because Bron loved bees. She's a beekeeper. It's her passion. She's crazy about them. And so she wanted to sell her honey. To sell honey, you need to have a commercial kitchen. So they built a commercial kitchen to sell honey, and they're like, okay, well, this is great. Now we need a place to sell it, so open a store on the farm. So now they have their bees, they have a kitchen, they have a store. Like, well, we should have more stuff in here, so we need to grow stuff. So they started growing stuff to sell in the store with stuff from the kitchen with the honeybees. And then they realized, well, we can only be open, you know, for a few months a year like this, and we're not really getting too many vegetables in the store, so we need to talk to an expert. So they called a gentleman named Elliot Coleman, who is the small-scale organic farming guru of the world. He knows his stuff. So they call Elliot, like, Elliot, we got a great project going outside of Chicago. Will you please help us out, to come out, consult on this project, and help us do what you do so well? And he said, no way, I'm way too busy for that. But the people that just run his farm had just moved to Chicago a few months earlier to work at the Botanic Gardens. His name is Mike Bollinger and Katie Prochaska, one of those two. So they call up Mike and Katie and say, hey, we got a great opportunity. We really want, you know, we want to have a local, sustainable, organic, small-scale farm that we can grow things. And not just grow a lot of things off a small space, but be able to grow them and sell them throughout the year, not just, you know, June through October, like most farms would do. So Mike and Katie said, well, this sounds like fun. So they came out and they implemented this system right here at the farm could do that, can get down and dirty and have grow a lot of vegetables in a small scale, so in a small space. About 10 to 12 months, you know, depending on the season out of the year. A lot more has happened since then I'm going to get to, but first, since we're here, we're talking about vegetables, we're talking about food production, I'm just going to start right now into our food production and growing techniques. So Elliot Coleman came up with a lot of these ideas, but he certainly was not the original small-scale farmer. He's kind of led the charge in the rebirth of small-scale agriculture in America. However, where really the techniques that we use, that Elliot discovered, have their roots in Paris. As far back as 1670 in Versailles. The French take their food very seriously, as we all know, even though we now call them freedom fries, you know. But the French they have very high standards for the food. And what else are the French known for besides great food is great wine? And I think that's an important thing to note real quick is that viticulture, which is growing of grapes for wine production, this is like, you know, the wine industry is one of the last industries that actually appreciate what I'm talking about when I talk about the soil. They have a word for it, terroir, right? Yeah, if anybody's, you guys drink wine, all right? Okay, cool. So you guys know what I'm talking about, the terroir, where you can have the same grape grown in a different soil, in a different climate, and a experienced sommelier, if you will be able to taste that, and they can say, I can taste the terroir of that climate. And they'll come over here, same exact grape, same variety, nothing's different except the soil and the climate. They taste that and they'll be able to know which region it came from based on the terroir, because the soil and the climate affects the flavor. And that's true of anything growing in the ground. But we just don't even realize that anymore. We don't think about it. We get a carrot, we call it a carrot. We don't know what variety it is, let alone where that variety was grown. It's just a carrot. Wine people get that still. And I think that they should be commended for it. So anyway, that's just my thing about wine. So the French really cared about the quality of their food. They knew that their food quality was closely tied to the way it was produced or raised. So they invested a lot of time. In fact, it was a very high up position back in the 1600s to be the royal potager. Any French majors? No? Okay, good, because I'm not saying that right, I'm sure. So this guy's name was La Quintine. Quintine. This French guy was the royal farmer. The royal gardener, in fact, is what it translates to. And he was growing food for the royal family at Versailles. And he was very innovative and started having some really rustic season extension techniques. And when I say season extension, that's what I'm talking about, taking, you know, manipulating the climate so that you can grow food in different times of the year. By the 1800s, those techniques had kind of been mastered by the Parisians in general. And by 1850, Paris, population of 1 million, was producing 100% of their vegetables within their own city walls. And they were doing it quite well. In fact, they did it so well that they started exporting it to London because they had a surplus. 1 million people inside Paris city walls, which I think is really, really impressive. Of course, everything back then was organic because we didn't know how to synthesize nitrogen and didn't know how to take the juice from a dude and put it into a plant. Organic was just growing. It was just food. It was just how you did things. So how did the French market gardeners get so good at this? What did they do to be so productive in such a small scale space? They did three things. They manipulated the soil, they manipulated the plants themselves, and they manipulated the environment around the plants. When I talk about manipulating the soil, I don't mean, you know, manipulating, changing it, but I mean adding to it. Plants, obviously, we all know, pull up nutrients from the soil, and some plants put nutrients back in, or this is where we get more organic. We can help the soil along by adding some of those nutrients from other natural sources into it. So they heavily amended the soil. Oh, see, PowerPoint mistake. There we are. So these gentlemen here are some of I like to think of them as my farmer ancestors, the pioneers of small-scale, local, organic agriculture that we read about in every magazine today. And here they are carrying giant piles of poop on their backs. So this is one of the horse stables that was in Paris. I was told to use both screens, so we can look at this one too. And this is, you know, back then, primary mode of transportation, of course, was horses, carts, and buggies, that sort of thing. And they all pooped. The horses did. Still do today. And they would collect the manure in different city stables and carry it to add it to the to their soil to amend it. It wasn't just manure that they would use. Being relatively close to the ocean, they could go and get things like seaweed that has trace minerals from the ocean that, again, being farmers, didn't really know why it worked so well because they weren't scientists, but they knew it worked. So they went and gathered the, you know, green sand and seaweeds like kelp and would mix that with the soil, or excuse me, with the manure to create compost, and then add that to their soil. So they had super nutrient-dense soils, so they could grow an immense amount of vegetables and not deplete the nutrient levels in the soil, but actually be building it up. So even though you're pulling pounds and pounds of vegetables out of the ground, they are increasing the health and the life and the vitality of that soil. They would also manipulate the plants. Oh, real quick, almost forgot. 100 tons per acre of that stuff. That's a lot. It's a poop load. All right, okay, let's see, PowerPoint. Boom. Okay, manipulating the environment. They would take, this is a picture here, it's a little interesting. First of all, let's notice a couple things, but I already skipped a point. PowerPoint's got me all flustered. Manipulating the plants, you can kind of see inside these plants here. These, I'm not sure what vegetables are growing under these bell jars here. It could be early tomatoes. It could be anything, but notice how closely they're planted together. Okay, so but normally a traditional mind would say, let's give the plant as much room as possible so it grows to be as big as possible. But what the French realized is that if you grow plants closer together, they might be smaller, but you get a whole lot more. So your net gain is significantly larger when you grow in dense positions like that. There's also other things like pruning and that stuff that we'll talk about later. This is them manipulating the environment, though. This is their primitive greenhouse. These are bell jars that are covering plants that are growing. This is obviously pretty cool out. You can see these guys seem fairly bundled up. I'm guessing this to be an early spring or late fall day. And they're tucking their plants away for a good night's rest. These bell jars, of course, cover one plant each every morning. Had to be leaned over and have a little prop of a stick up there to ventilate and not cook the plants because it would get very, very hot very, very fast. It's just a small jar like that. And then at night they'd come and for each single one, they'd pull that stick out, cover that bell jar back up, and now it's going to trap the heat that was created in there during the day for the night so it doesn't die. That wasn't really enough though, so what they did is they had these mats that you can see rolled up here, this log right here, and they would unroll them over the bell jars to extra a double layer of insulation to keep those plants nice and warm. So they wouldn't, you know, these are frost tender plants, obviously, drops below 30 degrees. If they weren't doing this, they'd lose that entire crop. So, interestingly enough, backwards, oh, too far, boom, there it is, the poo pile. Also, really, really warm. The, you know, compost, as it breaking down organic matter, can get, very, very high, over 100 degrees. And so when they amend the soil, they're also adding heat that's breaking down. They had these things called cold frames that were like large bell jars that were, or a box with a glass lid, and you would add the manure in there, and that supplemental heat would keep those plants warm too. So they were doing a lot of different things that way. So this is our ancestry of small-scale agriculture. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about how we do it now. This is Heritage Prairie Farm. I think that's Mike. That's Mike up there, my farming mentor. So how do we do it now? How do we translate what we used to do, what the Parisian forefathers did, to what we do now? Well, we do the same thing. We manipulate the soil, we manipulate the plants, and we manipulate the environment around the plants. We just do it in a little bit different way. First thing that will never change is amending the soil. Compost is the lifeblood of organic farming. It is the best way to increase fertility in your soil, increase that life that exists in that soil web that I was talking about before. So that doesn't change. What has changed is the type of compost we use. We now have lots of problems like E. coli or salmonella. You guys hear like, don't eat spinach or don't eat tomatoes. There's a salmonella on tomatoes. Well, that doesn't normally happen. That happened because someone put poop on that tomato, and we can't do that. So now we take compost, and compost now is a very specific method that has to be regulated by the government to make sure that it's what we call finished compost. So it goes through a process, kills the bacteria. It has to be heated up to a certain temperature, turned three times, heated back up to that temperature, held at that temperature for 3 days, then can be called compost. Then it's food safe. You can eat it, but I wouldn't. And this is the finished compost we use. When the time the compost gets to be this finished, we're now at about 16 tons per acre, down from 100. I would imagine the starting amount is probably the same, but once it breaks down into a more finer finished product, that's what we deal with now. But we also add the minerals. We also add the kelp. So I buy it dehydrated in a jar, and I can grind it up and mix it into water and spray it onto my field. We use other minerals like lime. We need a lot of lime in our soil in this area. So we take it a little step further now, though, by doing extensive soil tests every single year. We go from plot to plot, looking at each plant to, soil area to find out exactly what's going on in there. Does a certain area need a little bit more of this mineral than that? And also, it's just good to make sure that we are maintaining that soil health. Because again, we're growing You know, we're treating soil, not treating plants. So make sure we pay attention to the soil. We also do a lot of crop rotations. You know, like I mentioned, each plant takes up a certain nutrient uptake from the ground. For instance, tomatoes will take up, we call them a heavy feeder, lots of nitrogen, lots of phosphorus. We grow tomatoes there again. We'll probably get by, we'll be okay. But we grow tomatoes there 3 years in a row. There's no more nitrogen or phosphorus in the ground. But there's other plants that will put nitrogen and phosphorus back in. And there's other things we can do by adding compost and minerals and putting it back into the soil to make up for that. So in a combination of amending the soil and making sure we stay on top of our crop rotations, we can really make sure we're not depleting our soil or abusing our soil. We manipulate our plants. Again, we have very, very dense plant spacing. This is a picture of one of our greenhouses. This row here, the red stuff in it, that's lettuce. The green stuff, that's lettuce too. The other green stuff is kale, the other green stuff is chard. And the little green stuff is radish. We'll talk about that in a second. So this is, our bed spacing is 30 inches wide. And this is where we talk about small scale, high production. This is really important. 30 inch wide bed spacing, 12 inch walking ways. There's been study after study after study done by farmer after farmer after farmer. Never really a scientist. This is farmers trying to figure out the best way to do it. And they, you know, everybody pretty much agreed that the best, the most efficient use of space, notice I'm talking about space, not labor or time, the most efficient use of space is about a 30-inch bed with a 10 to 12-inch walkway. In a traditional growing method, even organic farming, still heavy use of machinery, you need a lot of room for machines to get around, you'll have three rows of lettuce in a 5 or 4 foot bed. And ours is just 30 inches. The pro to having all that space is that you can not have to pay people like me to go pull weeds out of there. But the con is that you need like three times as much space to grow the same amount of vegetables. So we have very dense plant spacing. This is Red Cross is the name of the variety. If any of you guys are home gardeners, Johnny's, it's the best lettuce you'll ever have, I swear. The other thing, though, is something called multi-cropping. And so I'm going to use this one now. This line right here, right next to the lettuce, those are radishes. And this is called multi-cropping, where you can, you know, take a little bit of unused space that lettuce doesn't really need when it's only 2 weeks old. And radishes will get to full size within 30 days of seeding. So that space can be used by the radish for 30 days, and then the plant will grow over, the lettuce will grow after 30 days as it gets larger, and then we'll use that space. So we're really kind of growing two crops in the same area at the same time, and that's kind of a fun way to get just a little bit extra plants out of the ground. We also do a lot of succession planting, which means that we never leave the soil bare. There's always something growing there, and that's really important. The other thing that we get to do is pruning. These are sun gold tomatoes. So pruning is really